So the email read, "Please receive my cousin at the airport." It was from one of my wife's friends, Bukhari, whom she met during a two-month mission stay in Burkina Faso, which is up in West Africa. They had remained friends for some time now. Still to this day, we exchange emails back and forth. Bukhari still doing mission work, helping to get medical supplies and medical personnel to parts of West Africa. We stayed in touch all these years. But this particular email came several years ago when we lived in Georgia, and it was a cold January night, much like these days that we've had. Emily happened to look at her phone and see that it popped up, and the email read just as I simply said, one statement, "Please receive my cousin at the airport." There was no name, no flight itinerary, no date, no picture. And all we could imagine as we sat there that is some young person is traveling from Burkina Faso to Atlanta, Georgia, and will arrive in Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport by themselves. You can imagine how anxious we were about this. And so we immediately wrote to Bukhari and said, "Please tell us their name and maybe a picture and what flight they're on so that we can go and greet them at this airport." Well, knowing the time difference, we realized we probably wouldn't get a chance to get that information back in time. So we quickly started to look at possible flights that would travel from Burkina to Atlanta. And we found just a couple, and they all incidentally landed the next morning. And so we quickly went to bed, got up early in the morning, made some posters that said, "Bukhari's cousin." What else did we have? So we went to the airport, and we were those people standing out there. And if you've flown into Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport, it's a massive, cavernous place, and just thousands of people moving through. And we stood there and stood there and stood there until finally Emily said, "Oh, there he is. He looks just like his cousin," thankfully. And so we ran up to him, and we held the sign up that said, "Bukhari's cousin," and he just nodded. And we gave him a big hug, and then we quickly realized that Yusuf knew no English. And we knew of no plan other than to receive him. And so we did the only thing we thought we could do. We took him home. Now that may seem completely outlandish to us, unbelievable that someone would fly all the way from the other side of the world to come here to the United States without a clear plan of where they're going and who will meet them there. It seems completely preposterous that that would happen. But incidentally, after all of these years, almost five now, working for the Global Methodist Church and serving the more than 1,400 ministries that your church, that all of our churches support in more than 80 countries, I've learned that maybe we're the ones who are the outsiders. Maybe we're the ones who look for the flight itineraries and the plans and the names, because the rest of the world, the role of hospitality, of welcoming a spontaneous traveler is a great gift to them, and their response is unbelievable. I can remember traveling in some small villages, and they'll see me and not know that I'm coming, and climb and grab a coconut and bring it to me, or instantly welcoming into their home. Their way of living in many of the parts of this world expresses a hospitality that's so unknown to us because we're so organized and so busy, and we have massive airports. So maybe we're the outsiders. I think that this passage today, which I know may be a bit confusing for you, offers some insight for us about how we live as Christians. Now, admittedly, how many people have you read the birth of Jesus story outside of Christmas? It's one of the things we don't do. We sort of compartmentalize our scripture into certain periods of time. And the Christmas narrative, the birth of Jesus, always for us is in December. And we read it in light of that whole experience. Well, one of the things that we've recognized over time is that when we as Christians, particularly here in North America, read a passage during December, along comes with it a host of traditions. Some of those are really valuable, wonderful traditions, family traditions, local church traditions. Then you have the broader historical religious traditions. But you also have the consumeristic traditions that we have about what Christmas looks like. It's impossible for us to read the story of Jesus being born without thinking of elves and Santa Claus and stockings and Christmas presents and family coming or not having family there. All of those things, those wrap that whole story around. So sometimes I think it's incredibly valuable to take something that's so familiar and read it in a place that seems a bit unfamiliar. So that's what we're going to do today, and I hope you'll humor me in this exercise. So we know the common story, right? The story that Jesus is born in a manger behind some inn, and that Mary and Joseph are in Bethlehem on the back of a donkey. I still can't imagine what it would be like for a 9-month pregnant woman to be on the back of a donkey and what that drive would be like. But they do, and that's end up in that spot. But let's take for a moment and look at this. For those who know me, I really do enjoy some historical criticism, sort of looking at the scripture and trying to place it within a historical context. And so as I started to do that for this sermon today, I began at the inn, which was the inn. So much of our tradition wraps around that last phrase, Jesus was born wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger, because there was no room in the inn. Even Michael shared in a sermon the storybook that he wrote for the children, how St. Francis of Assisi helped move people around that story by creating that whole narrative and that whole image of Jesus in the manger and the animals and the shepherds and in some cases now the wise men all gathered around. But if we look at it for just a second, we see things maybe just a bit different. So let's start with the inn. I started to look at that word, and the word there that is used to describe an inn is probably more appropriately translated to the word guest room or guest house. In fact, it's used again in Luke 22, and there it's referring to the upper room where Jesus meets his disciples for that feast. So in other places in the Bible, it's translated to guest room. But here in this case, most commonly as inn. The other thing we know about the period is that there weren't inns like we have. I mean, when I think of an inn, we think of, you know, a roadside hotel, Hampton Inn, maybe. We think of those kinds of things. Those things hadn't been developed. They won't be developed until much later, and only first then in places like Jerusalem, larger cities, not in the small town of Bethlehem. So maybe then it's not so much that there's no room in the inn, but there's no room in the guest room, which changes things for a little bit. Because now what do we know about ancient architecture? Well, we learned that in these peasant homes, that most of them are constructed of one major room, and then a small room is attached to it or detached, and that is the guest room. And that's where people who were traveling came to stay. Now, back in that day, of course, they didn't fly to Cancun for a vacation. They would go to visit family and friends for feasts and celebrations and important holidays and family moments. And so they would stay with family and friends, not in hotels like we have the opportunity to do. And so these guest rooms were very prominent parts of their homes. So now we begin to think, okay, so the story goes something like this, maybe, that Mary and Joseph are going to Bethlehem for the census, and then if we look at the beginning of the phrase, it says, while they were there. So we understand then that maybe Mary and Joseph actually had been there for some time, staying presumably with Joseph's family. This is Joseph's hometown. And so they are full, though. The whole house, the guest room is full, because all of these family are coming back to be counted for the census. So now we encounter the story where they're there, they've been there for a while, it comes time for Mary to give birth, and the whole house is full. So what does the family do? Well, the next thing we know about this ancient historic architecture is that this one room served a multitude of tasks. It was usually one large room with an elevated loft or sometimes a second floor where the family would sleep at night, and during the day they would use the whole of the house. But at night, they would often bring their cattle, their animals, into the home with them. And they would live in there overnight to keep them from the dangerous weather, from the wild animals, and from thieves. And additionally, they think that it helped to keep the house warm with all the added body heat. So then a manger was a traditional part of the home in this period. It was a stone usually embedded in the ground, a carved-out stone that held water for the animals while they slept in the house at night. So now all of a sudden, we see this manger, and we hear the proclamation of the angels to the shepherds, and it's starting to make sense to us that this Jesus, this Prince of Peace, this Messiah is being born in a normal house and will be laying in a normal fixture of that normal house of peasants, people like us, normal people. And so now the story evolves more. This child is born. There's no room in the guest room. And so they clear out the livestock. They make room within the house. And now you can imagine maybe that the women are all gathered around Mary as she gives birth to this new life. And the children and the males may be up in the loft or maybe outside avoiding it. But in any case, we see the whole community making space for God to be born with us. For me, that changed the way I looked at this whole narrative. For so long, I just thought of Jesus being born, rejected and isolated. But instead, we see Jesus being born in the midst of real life, in a real home, in a real place with real people. And it took those real people to determine and decide that they were going to make room for God to be born in their midst. Maybe our job as Christians Maybe our response to this, not our job, our response to this is to carry on that same kind of hospitality, to make room for God in our homes, in our neighborhoods, in our communities, in our workplaces, and that our job of making room allows God to be in those places too. I want to tell you another story about a young couple great with child, and its story, though, involves me. My wife, Emily, and I moved here almost 5 years ago, it'll be 5 years April. And our first weekend here, we unpacked our stuff in the apartment, and literally I was coming back from Target getting trash cans and random shower curtains, the things you don't realize you need at a new place. And I opened the door about midnight, and she's standing there with the pregnancy test. We found out we were pregnant the very first night we stayed here in Nashville. So here we were, a couple moving 333 miles from anybody we knew. And at first, when you're just two, you think you can make it, but then you realize, well, I'm going to have a child, and we got to do this all on our own. We had no structure of support, no family, no friends, nothing. So we began to look as quickly as we could. We visited almost every Methodist church in this community. And let me tell you, it was hard. It is really hard to go into a church you know no one and sit down and try to experience worship and try to make friends. In fact, we ended up here, not because we connected with people, but we connected with the worship service, with the choir, with Michael's sermons, with his place, and the fact that we could walk here was another benefit. And it took many months for us to feel connected to this place at all. We would come and we'd worship and we'd sing and we'd leave, desperately looking for someone just to eat lunch with, just to talk to. Poor Emily had to deal with just me. She needed more. We needed more. And it wasn't until someone invited us to a Sunday school class. Incidentally, the name of the class is Making Room. And it wasn't until that point, which we went into this place and got to know some people, that this church made room for us. It created space and opportunity to encounter God in this place in ways we never imagined. We created friends and really family who will last with us for all our life, and children to play with our children. This church, through its Sunday school offerings and through the braveness of someone inviting us and meeting us to that place, and made room for us. So maybe making room is not just about making room for God, because again, Emmanuel is not God with me, it's God with us. So maybe our response to this with us is that we become creators of space. We make room for those to come and join us. That we look around our pews today, and instead of being scared whether or not they're members or not, we just say hello to them. And we invite them to come to Sunday school. We invite them to go to lunch. That we're those sorts of people so that we can allow God to have space in our lives. So may you be bearers of making room. Yusuf stayed with us for a couple of months. It turned out he was enrolled in a language school at Georgia Tech. And it took our work with the Georgia Tech faculty, and it took the faculty at the school I worked at that spoke French to figure this whole thing out. And then it took our whole friends who had clothes the same size as him to keep him warm through the winter here that he'd never experienced before. It took my family who allowed him to come on family vacations. It took all of us, and it took Yusuf too, to create space so that he had a home, so he had a community. So we had a place. Our job then, our response to God's grace to us, is to make room for others and to make room for God.